Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned the following may contain names and voices of deceased persons.
We found a bowerbird nest, and in that bowerbird nest were some knuckles, of human knuckles.
Come back, we're telling them, you're probably going to get killed. Come back. Then it'll come back.
Flood time is when people disappear.
His body was already finished in the bag, body bag.
This is Wrong Skin, an investigation into a suspicious death and a missing person in the Australian outback. I'm Richard Baker, a journalist with the Melbourne Age in Australia. On December 8, 1994, at the beginning of the wet season, a group of schoolboys and their dogs walked a few kilometres out of the remote Aboriginal township of Looma in Australia's far northwest. The boys were gathering red-coloured bush tucker, known as cockleberries. But their dogs discovered something else under a scrubby tree, something that caused them to race back to Looma.
And it was a couple of schoolboys?
Yeah.
Do you remember what happened when they came back?
Oh, they was shivering, mate. They was fright. They didn't know what they was really scared.
That's senior Looma man, Joe Killer, remembering the petrified state of the boys after their dogs led them to a decomposing body, partially clothed in a denim skirt. The body would be later identified as a 23-year-old Looma mum, Julie Buck. She'd vanished 11 months earlier at the height of the wet season, the time of the year when the Kimberley is hit with dense tropical lows and flooding rains. Looma can be cut off for weeks on end. It's a spectacular but dangerous time. I've been fortunate enough to travel all over the world and Australia, and there's nowhere else like the Kimberley. The environment is so seductive, but it feels as though it could turn on you at any minute.
Flood warnings have also been issued for the east, west and north Kimberley rivers, along with the Fitzroy River.
Heavy rain are thrashing parts of the Kimberley region in Western Australia.
Roads throughout the Kimberley, including Great Northern Highway, have been shut by floodwaters and may be closed for weeks.
It wasn't just Julie who went missing in late January 1994. Her 24-year-old boyfriend, Richard Milgan, disappeared. He was from Looma as well. There's been no trace of him since. Richard's presumed dead. Most likely, he died for the same reason Julie did. The death of Julie and disappearance of Richard left two young kids without a mum and a dad, and forever changed Looma. The mystery of what happened to Julie and Richard is the most compelling I've come across in 20 years of journalism. I only found out about it when a friend from the West Australian desert rang me out of the blue and said I should talk to his mate up in the Kimberley about something bad that happened. He said it was the sort of thing the rest of Australia needs to know about. After a long silence, people in Looma are starting to open up, particularly the women.
We're sad that, she left a daughter behind. She won't just disappear or take off and leave her behind.
But I told them, it's best to put it out there so these people can get put away.
A lot of the voices you're going to hear are rarely heard in the media. And that's one of the reasons we're doing this podcast.
Like they talk amongst themselves.
If a young mum's body was found under a bush in Melbourne, Sydney or Perth, chances are most of us would have heard about it. Even more so if her boyfriend went missing at the same time. There would have been newspaper reports and TV news coverage on the dead mum and missing boyfriend. A police press conference to appeal for information. But with this case, there's nothing on the public record. No cause of death for Julie, no one charged, no coronial inquest. The only thing out there is a 1995 missing person poster. This is more than just another true crime style podcast. Like me, you're going to have to get out of your comfort zone and come to a part of Australia few of us know enough about. Up here, English is a second, third, or fourth language for many in the Indigenous population. To understand what might have happened to Richard and Julie, and why, we need to get to grips with some huge themes. This is all about love, power, fear, and consequence in the oldest continuous culture on our planet. You can bring me down. You'll be surprised what goes on in our own backyard.
This way, mate, I'll just show you that way. Yeah. You can turn around in over there where the car is.
Sure.
Yeah.
Joe Killer took me around Luma at the tail end of this year's record wet season. After months of long phone conversations, I've come to Luma in the hope people will talk to me and to get a feel for the community Julie and Richard were living in when they vanished. Luma's a far-flung place. It's a 90-minute drive inland from Derby, with the last 30 or so kilometres on a rough, red, Pindan dirt track. It's about 2,500 kilometres by road from Western Australia's capital city of Perth, which itself is often touted as the world's most isolated capital. Getting to Luma is pretty much impossible without a four-wheel drive at this time of year. As a city slicker who rides his push bike to work, Luma's rough tracks are testing my driving skills.
This is different.
Something Joe Killer doesn't fail to miss.
You're right, damn right, don't get bogged.
No, I'm not going to get
bogged. When you meet Joe for the first time, you soon learn he loves a laugh and is extremely fit for a man who's just turned 70. He wears a big cowboy hat, like lots of men in these parts, and his long-sleeved blue shirt covers a barrel chest. His only concession to age is a blue haze across his big brown eyes. Joe later tells me he needs eye surgery.
This is the new house. Used a creek run through here, but okay. They blocked that out. That used to be a church. Go this way, mate.
Yep.
Joe gets his name from his dad, Killer Naga, who founded Luma in the mid-70s as a place for former Aboriginal cattle station workers to live. Lots of them lost their jobs on nearby stations after a ruling in the 60s that they had to be paid the minimum wage. Some station owners were refusing to pay.
That's all this mark you see, like tank and that bore and everything, that mark, all the people to drill where to get the water. He told them, do you drill them here?
And he knew.
Joe's dad was born in the desert, south of the Kimberley. He worked on a cattle station where his prowess at killing cattle earned him his name.
A drain here, see? That's my brother live here. Okay. My son live here.
Joe's proud of his family's presence in Luma, a place which is home to about 500 people from the Kimberley's Nigana, Mangala and Walmajari mobs.
This is my brother's place, David.
So what's this? Is this New Luma or old?
Yeah, New Luma.
New Luma. Yep.
Yeah, that's my other son-in-law. Other son-in-law, this one. Big mother tribe. That's one of my new tribes. That's daughter's place, and this one my mother played. He passed away.
Luma folk listen to country and western music. They also go to church a lot. The township has a school, a general store, a health clinic, and a footy ground with lights. It's home to the mighty Luma Eagles Australian rules team. There's an old part where the first houses were built. Many of these look a bit worse for wear. And a new section with more modern homes. The school kids look happy and playful, just like children anywhere else. There's lots of mongrel dogs lying around in the shade. They're friendly enough, though they did make me think when I'd last had my tetanus shot. Luma has strong leaders and is among the best and safest remote communities in the Kimberley. Still, social problems caused by grog, drugs, domestic violence, poverty and unemployment rear up from time to time.
Just bush.
Just bush.
As I drop Joe off at his house, he says he'll take me exploring if I come back when it's not so wet.
You would love to climb in the hills.
I'd love to go up there.
One day when you come up in dry season, you can climb this hill.
And
if you don't, you climb up this one. If you are a chance out of swimming, the swimming pool out the top where the kids go swimming.
Luma's beautiful in the wet season.
Go swimming in the rock.
It sits on the Fitzroy River floodplain, and at this time of year, it's lush and green. The river is everything to people here. It provides food, a place to relax and escape the brutal heat and humidity. More than anything, though, the river's like a living creature, something to cherish and protect. Behind Luma, there's a big granite ridge which really hits you after driving through hours of flat landscape. Those hills look like they hold secrets.
You know, in lower ways,
yeah,
you can chug around this way.
As we drive around town, Joe points to one of the hills. That's where Julie's body was discovered.
And that night, where they're talking about the found body was here, this way, from over there. This way.
Yeah. How far?
Oh, a long way from here. Good distance. Yeah.
Before we explore the theories of how Julie ended up where she did and what might have happened to Richard, we need to get to know who they were and why their relationship was causing so much angst.
We grew up together. We grew up together in the hostel. School.
That's Lisa Skinner. She went to school with Julie and Richard at the United Aborigines Mission in Derby in the 1980s. Lisa and Julie were best friends, almost like sisters. They hung out, annoyed their older siblings, and swapped clothes.
We was real close because me and her same age. Very close. We only had each other. We only had each other in the hostel. And we were the first, last lot of children out of the hostel when they closed it down.
And Julie's remembered in Luma as gentle, kind and pretty. She was happiest whenever she was around the river with her family. She adored her daughter, Zaria.
Hello.
Hello, Graham. It's Richard here. How are you?
Oh, hang on. I'll just get in at the moment. Hang on.
Thanks.
I'm trying to reach Julie's big brother, Graham. The top half of Western Australia is enormous.
Yeah,
hey, Graham, it's Richard here. How are you going?
The Kimberley's roughly the size of Victoria, but only has about 40,000 people. This means mobile phone coverage can be patchy and people hard to find.
She had a warm face and a loving smile, really.
That's Graham Bodie talking about his sister's warmth. It took me a few months to find him. He's in Port Hedland, a 7-hour drive south of the Kimberley. When he was a kid, in the 60s, he was part of the Stolen Generations.
I remember them days, you know, bits and pieces.
A policy that for decades saw mixed-race Aboriginal children taken from their families to be raised the European way. Graham was fostered out to a white family in Derby, but he wanted to be with his brothers and sisters in Luma.
I got taken away and it's like I weren't allowed to go and see him on weekends and shit like that on school holidays, and I kept away from him.
Graham's never forgotten how he used to run away to Luma, only to be picked up by welfare officers and taken back to his foster family in Derby.
And the welfare would come back and pick me up and take me back.
Julie's best friend Lisa remembers some fun times with Julie and her big brother Graham.
He used to take us everywhere with his motorbike, around town. Speedway, like she's in the front and I'm in the back, and doing his wheelies and everything.
Did you ever get scared?
No.
I think he's 1 year older than me.
Richard?
Yeah.
Is he a good bloke?
One of the best.
That's Wayne Watson. He grew up close to Richard and Julie. We're on the banks of the Fitzroy River on a stinking hot afternoon. Wayne's up for a swim, but I'm too scared of the crocs. He doesn't hold back. He reckons they don't eat black people. We eat bush turkey and barramundi and talk about everything.
Going to family.
It's not easy for him to talk about his mate Richard, who he hasn't seen for so long.
It's the last time I seen him, me and him was working.
Where were you working?
Loader bringer.
It's a station.
Yeah, it's a station. But when he took off, I thought he was gone. Like, gone to Darwin or somewhere.
On my most recent trip to Luma in July 2018, I spoke with another Wayne, this time Richard Milgan's younger brother, Wayne Milgan. After months of talking privately with me, Wayne's ready to let the world know what kind of man his brother was.
Yeah, he was a good guy. We used to play music together in a band. Yeah, he used to play the drum. Good at sport, basketball, football. Always have that smile, like make other people laugh, all his friends. Yeah, he was a good bloke, my brother.
Julie's friend Lisa also remembers Richard with great affection.
He was a happy person. I mean, you know, he was a really happy person. He never argued or anything with anybody. He had heart, but in a spoiled way, I said, I used to get wild with him. He wanted, this and that, but I suppose because he was young,
Do you remember him as a boy?
This a young bloke, happy-go-lucky. This he wasn't hurting anybody, but he had eyes for that girl, you see.
Well, what was she like? What did she look like?
She was a bit happy too, Very nice lifestyle and all. When that thing been take place, when they took off, like bush married, made together.
That phrase Joe used, bush marriage, is really important, and we're going to come back to it soon.
I lived at old fella. Yeah, this old fella had a couple of wives, wouldn't he?
Joe's telling us about Richard and Julie and the old fella she was promised to. His name's Jimmy Nerima. And he already had a few wives across his 70 years. I've only got one photo of Julie and two of Richard. You can see them on the Wrong Skin website. One shows a handsome, smiling Richard, perhaps in his early teens. He looks every inch the cheeky young man his friends remember him as. The other photo tells a different story. It looks to be a police mugshot that was used on his missing person poster. But it's the photo of Julie that hits hard. She must be around 10 or 11. It's like a faded watercolour painting with her as a smiling spectral presence at its centre. She's sitting on the bank of a river or a billabong. She looks thin but strong in a wiry way. Her green dress blends into the Kimberley landscape. The photo was probably taken about the time Julie's mum died when she was hit by a car. This would determine the direction of the rest of Julie's life.
Yeah, hit and run. My mum wanted to adopt them in because their mother passed away. She got killed. But the other families didn't allow it. They didn't want them to stay with my mum. And mum said, well, these kids, they grew up with us. We are the only family they know. So they promised Julie, big sister, to our cousin brother, and we didn't like it. Well, mum, she couldn't say anything. It was the old man who was doing all that,
Arranged marriages and promising of young girls still happens around the world in different cultures. In Australia, some Indigenous societies stopped the practice long ago. But in the Kimberley, promising out young girls to older men was still occurring in the 90s.
Julie was only really young when she got... she was only about 12, 13... when she got promised that. And I was real upset. I said, no, is she any young? They told me, you can't talk.
Despite Lisa's mother offering to take Julie and her siblings in, the decision wasn't hers to make. Julie and her sister were promised out. Investigating what happened to Richard and Julie and its effect on the people who love them has made me feel more of an outsider than any other story in my career. On the matter of promised brides, I'm torn between thinking who am I to question cultural practices that have been going on in the Kimberley for thousands of years, and wondering how any girl, my own 10-year-old daughter comes to mind, would feel about being promised out to a man two or three times her age.
This is my poem that attacks the silly habit that man has been in the habit of doing. He's always looking for a young woman, and you see summer and winter coming together, which is always so very sad.
That's Oojuru Noonuccal, one of Australia's most renowned Indigenous poets, introducing her poem, Child Wife. Her English name was Kath Walker. Her poem was written more than 40 years ago, proof that some Aboriginal women have been pushing back against promised brides for a long time.
My people, no exception to the rule, the young girls were handed over to the old men, and this is my protest against such a thing. The child wife. They gave me to an old man, joyless and old. Life's smile of promise so soon to frown. Inside his gunya, my childhood over. I must sit forever. And the tears fall down. It was love I longed for, young love like mine. It was Dunwa wanted me, the gay and brown. Our old laws that tether me, our long years awaiting me, and the grief comes over me, and the tears fall down.
Julie's first relationship with a much older man produced her only daughter, Zaria. She had Zaria in her mid-teens and became pregnant while working as a Jillaroo, a female cattle station worker. Julie was working at Nookinbar Station, an hour's drive further inland from Luma. Her friends reckon Zaria's premature birth was prompted by Julie's continued horse riding. After Zaria was born, Julie's relationship with her daughter's much older father ended. Why? I don't know. But she was promised out again, this time to an even older man, Jimmy Nerima.
And I said, how can you do that? You know, like, you can get promised twice. I didn't know they can do that.
This house here, look. Old Jimmy used to live here.
Yep.
But he used to live in the old house. And this is where he was living. Yeah.
And was she living there then or not, the girl?
The girl was living with that old fella.
She was living
and
with Jimmy.
This young bloke was keep interfering.
The young bloke Joe Killer refers to is, of course, Richard Milgan. Though there's much in this story unfamiliar to those of us from non-Indigenous backgrounds, the one thing we can all relate to is being young and infatuated with someone. Richard's brother Wayne remembers the couple's relationship like this.
But in that time, like teenagers, you know, like, you know how teenagers were like, yeah.
You can't stop them.
Yeah, can't stop them.
Yeah. And that's what they were like?
Yeah. That was like that, yeah.
And that would prove to be a massive problem, because their relationship, their bush marriage, was forbidden under traditional laws. It made them wrong skin.
So every tribe has skin groups, and that's part of the marriage system and the ownership of land, or their country, they say.
That's Loretta Bin Omar, a senior Kimberley woman. She's giving me a layman's rundown of skin groups, marriage, and how the system has been corrupted since white colonisation.
Two people from one skin group can't marry each other. That's bad. That's not straight marriage. So you have to marry into another skin group. And because a lot of people were brought in the 1890s by missionaries and things, that has mucked up and interfered with the skin group system and the marriage system.
So once this story hooked me in, I realised I was getting into areas I knew very little about. So I tried to find someone who could give me a simple yet accurate overview of how skin and kinship rules work.
Really determines how people relate to each other, their roles and responsibilities, their obligations to each other. It can also determine the ceremonial relationships, such as roles for initiations, funerals, and also who you can marry.
Steve Hodder-Watt is an Indigenous man from Mornington Island in the Gulf of Carpentaria. He's been through traditional law. And although he's not from the Kimberley, he's lived and worked in Aboriginal communities across Australia and has a good grasp on skin and kinship rules. He points out that skin rules serve some very practical purposes.
There was a lot more emphasis on making sure that there wasn't that inappropriate crossover, which obviously means, you know, if you're talking about possibly incestuous relationships.
Skin and kinship rules are complex. They mean someone who is not related to you by blood can become family, a sister or a brother, an uncle or an auntie. It creates a massive support network. But it can also lead to problems, particularly if you find yourself irresistibly attracted to a person these rules say is poison. In Richard and Julie's case, several Luma women privately explained to me their skin ties meant she became like his mother. This is why their relationship was forbidden. What they were doing put them at risk of physical punishment from anyone who regarded themselves as an enforcer of traditional rules, or anyone who was just plain jealous.
Those people would get hiding and they'd be flogged out of the community and banished because they are wrong way people.
That's Loretta bin Omar again, talking about how a wrong-skinned couple would have been punished. Steve Hoddlewatt agrees.
Traditionally, and when we say traditionally, you're talking about when people lived in pretty brutal times as well. Back then, there would have been a greater focus on making sure that people kept in line and getting some of that tribal punishment and payback, as I guess it's called colloquially these days, was part of how the system of justice worked.
It seems as though Richard and Julie's relationship fell right on a fault line between the old ways and adapting to modern times. If what happened to them was connected in some way to tribal punishment, it'd be a push to justify it.
Aboriginal people were the longest living cultures in the world. The British have been here. You're talking maybe 5 seconds on a 12-hour clock in comparison to how long Aboriginal people have been here. So that has meant that the cultural practices have been diluted somewhat.
Whichever way you look at it, Richard and Julie appear to have paid an extremely high price for wanting to be together. Julie's big brother, Graham, wishes he was around in Luma to tell his sister not to go with someone who is wrong skin.
Can't find another wrong skin.
So you would have just said to her, look, saved her from any punishment.
I would have saved her, yeah.
We just keep cruising around for a while.
We're driving around Derby with Lisa, Julie's friend. Lisa's a few years shy of 50. She's the rock for everyone in her big family, the problem solver. She's tough and got a deadpan sense of humour.
Would she have someone's house to go to?
We're trying to find Julie's daughter, Zaria. Lisa's like an auntie to Zaria, who's now in her 30s. Zaria was 7 when she last saw her mum in a scene that still traumatises her. We didn't find Zaria that day, but Lisa spots someone else from the past.
That young fellow was standing in...
Someone important.
He was the one who found Julie's body.
Really?
Although the Kimberley covers a massive area, everyone and everything there is somehow connected. Take Julie's big brother, Graham. He was working as an orderly in the Derby morgue in December 1994 on the day police arrived with human remains from Luma. He says he instinctively knew who the bones belonged to.
Yeah, like Clyde.
So how did you know?
It's something that, I don't know, it's hard to explain. Know what I mean? It's like supernatural, I suppose. You sense things.
Lisa found out about Julie when she answered a knock at the door.
And this police by the name of Scott came. I had to show him my ID, photo, license and all that. For real, you're Lisa Skinner. And I said, yeah, why? What's going on? You can know, because they found a body there with Lisa Skinner on it. I'm like, what? What do you mean? Oh no, they found a body and I had a couple of clothes with your name on it. And I said, well, only person who I gave my clothes to is Julie Buck.
Next time on Wrong Skin.
It was fairly evident that there'd been some flooding through the area during the wet, which two things: easy to get rid of a body, but also difficult to find a body.
You got spear and boomerang flying everywhere. It was that bad.
That was law made, you know. You're not allowed to say anything. You're a young bloke. You've got to revert back to the old people.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review Wrong Skin on iTunes. And if you know more about this story, email Richard Baker, rbaker@fairfaxmedia.com.au. Wrong Skin is investigated and presented by Richard Baker and produced by Rachel Dexter and Tim Young. The executive producer is Greg Muller, Tom McKendrick is head of video and audio, and Dr. Siobhan McHugh is consulting producer. The additional music track for this episode was Cloud 9, courtesy of Baker Boy and featuring Kian.